here in Matthew chapter 16, verses 13 through 28. Yesterday, we were in the first half, the last half of Matthew chapter 15, and then the first half of Matthew chapter 16, and what did we talk about? Yeah, good answer. Kingdom. What else? Cheat. Look at it. Like, what did we talk about? Feeding of the 4,000, yeah. What is significant about the feeding of the 4,000 compared to the feeding of the 5,000? Gentile territory, which theologically has a lot of impact because of what reason?
The message is
going
to the Jews up to now.
Yeah, because up until now, Jesus' ministry has primarily been focused on the Jewish territory, the Jewish people. And now he's doing the same miracles. He's teaching the same things in Gentile territory. There is major theological significance of that, which we talked about yesterday. Yes?
This is way off topic.
Okay.
Don't forget about
attendance. Thank you. That isn't way off topic. As a matter of fact, yeah. Okay. Attendance. Make sure you sign it for yesterday as well, 26th and 27th. Thank you. That's not off topic. What else, though? After the feeding of the 4,000, what ended up occurring? Well, first of all, let me ask this question. How did the disciples respond whenever Jesus tells them to feed the 4,000? Yeah, why? Because it was the Gentiles, and they just don't get it yet, do they? And then we have another group that just doesn't get it in chapter 16, verse 1, with the Pharisees and Sadducees coming on the scene, and they basically start asking Jesus for a sign from heaven, right? And Jesus says, he kind of plays a game with them. I think he's like, okay, we'll talk about signs from the skies. Let's look at the sky. It's red and da-da-da-da-da. And then he basically says, you should be interpreting this, the signs of the age, and you're not. And then he talks about the yeast of the Pharisees, and how do the disciples respond to that? Yeah, they don't get it. They're like, oh no, he's mad at us because we forgot bread. Those darn basketfuls. You know, they don't get it. Well, we're going to continue that theme somewhat, except for we're going to start off with them totally getting it today. Chapter 16, verse 13 through 28, a big victory, a big boost of confidence in the kingdom of heaven because finally the disciples show glimmer of hope and that they get it. Although right after that, they destroy all hope when they don't get it. But anyway, we'll get there in a minute. Verse 13. Well, let me think. Is there anything I want to talk about this before I dive into it?
Hey,
yeah, sure.
This is only half of it. Is there supposed to be the same page?
Yeah, I'm on top of things today. There it is. There you go. What do I want to talk about? Confession of the kingdom. Jesus. Nah, we're not going to talk about that. Okay. Chapter 16, verse 13. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, okay, first of all, let's stop there. Caesarea Philippi, important city, because Philip the Tetrarch, who's Philip the Tetrarch? Philip the Second, who is he?
Herod's brother.
Herod Antipas' brother, Herod the Great's son. One of the sons that received parts of the kingdom whenever Herod the Great died, right? Caesarea Philippi is his capital city. Is the capital city of Philip the Tetrarch. And it's actually significant because of its history. It was initially called Panias, which was in honor of which Greek god, would you guess? Pan. Exactly. But whenever Philip Tetrarch took over the stuff, he renamed it. And he renamed it after both Caesar and himself. If that's not vain, I don't know what is. Caesarea Philippi, the capital of the kingdom of Rome, ruling in the region of the Jewish nation, and it's by the name of the person Philip. So there was a rebirthing of the city in honor of the emperor, the king of the empire, and it is in this city that is named after the king of Rome and the king of the region, over the emperor of the world and the ruler of the region, Caesar Philippi, Caesarea Philippi. It is in this region that Jesus asks, now who do you say that I am? We see that who this city says that they are, but who do you say that I am? So even the very fact that he says we're in Caesarea Philippi, it's setting the scene for a showdown. We'll get to that in a bit. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" What is Jesus asking? Identity? Yes. Whose identity? How do we know? I agree, but how do we know? Yeah, this isn't the first time that the Son of Man has been attached to Jesus, is it? Okay, let me list off how many times before. There is 9 times before this moment in which Jesus is referred to as the Son of Man, either by himself or someone else. You have Matthew chapter 8, verse 20, chapter 9, verse 6, chapter 10, verse 23, 11, 19, 12, 8, 12, 32, 12, 40, 13, 37, 13, 41. After this moment, Jesus will be referred to as the Son of Man 20 more times. The sheer volume of the Son of Man language in Matthew should let us know how significant that term is. It's a key identifying factor in the ministry of Jesus. It occurs 30 times in the Gospel of Matthew referring to Jesus. 30 times. No other Gospel will have that type of frequency. As a matter of fact, Son of Man isn't found all that frequent outside of Matthew. Matthew's one that hammers on it the most. And what is that saying about the lens of Matthew? Give me my Sunday school answer.
Kingdom.
Yeah. He's hammering kingdom stuff. This is kingdom language. So Jesus is saying, in essence, in this question, he's saying, who do people say that I am? Who do people say that I am? Which you see that in the parallel in chapter 16, verse 15. That's exactly the question, the way he rephrases it for his own disciples. Now listen to what the people say. Some, they replied, verse 14, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. Now, each of these figures, we have evidence of each of these figures being an eschatological figure at some point in Jewish understanding. John the Baptist, where have we heard his eschatological place in the kingdom already in the Gospel of Matthew? What's that?
Chapter 3,
kind of. Kind of, yes, I would accept that answer, but go up 2 chapters. 14. Who is speaking there about John the Baptist? He says, oh no, John the Baptist has come back from the dead and he has miraculous powers. Who said that? What? Herod Antipas. He's saying, oh no, John the Baptist is back from the dead. This eschatological figure that has come in order to cause me problems because I killed him. Some people say Jesus is John the Baptist. Other people say that he is Elijah, which would make sense in light of Matthew chapter 3, the stuff that was talked about with John the Baptist. It would also make sense in light of Malachi chapter 4, verse 5, because Elijah was supposed to be the one that comes before the Messiah, right? Well, then what about Jeremiah and one of the other prophets? In 4 Ezra 2:18, which is a Jewish document, it says, I will send you help, my servants Isaiah and Jeremiah. And this is God speaking to rebellious Israel about the restoration of them through the Messiah. He says, before the Messiah comes, who's going to come? Jeremiah, Isaiah, some of the other prophets. Now, here's my question. What is missing from this list? Who do people say that I am? Some say John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. Others say Jeremiah or one of the other prophets. What's missing? The Messiah. No one's buying into him. No one thinks he really is the one to come. Why?
Because he hasn't done any of the things that they were looking for.
Yeah. Because they're looking through the same lens that John the Baptist looked through. They're looking through the same lens the Pharisees and Sadducees are looking through. They're looking through the same lens that Satan was looking through in chapter 4. If you're going to be the Messiah, you've got to look a certain way. None of them, though, are buying into his ministry. None of them. Who do the people say that I am? You're only the one to come, or you're only the one before the one that comes. You're not actually him. To which Jesus responds by asking the question, but what about you? He asked. Who do you say that I am? I can picture Jesus going, do I want to ask this or not? based off of what we've just experienced in the past couple of chapters with the disciples and their understanding of the kingdom and his kingship, this is a pretty volatile question. All right, well, I hear what the crowds say. What do you say? And Simon Peter, in his shining moment before Pentecost, says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." What does Peter say? What is Peter's answer? Jesus asked him the question. He says, "Okay, I hear what the crowd say. Do you agree with them? Do you agree?" And what does Simon respond by saying? "No, we don't agree with them." Who do they say? Who do the disciples think that Jesus is? The Messiah. Interpret that for me. That is true. That is correct. He is the Messiah. What does that mean? Who is he?
The King.
The King. He is the King. He is the Christ, the Anointed One, which is the King and the Prophet and the Priest of the nation of Israel. He is the Son of the living God. Is that talking about deity? No. It's talking about His position as the King, the key connection between God and humanity. He is the King. Matter of fact, Son of the living God would have been very explosive to say in Caesarea Philippi, wouldn't it? Why? Oh yeah, what are on the coins of Caesar? Nothing more than the Son of God. Theos is a very key word that is thrown around quite a lot towards Caesar. But he is technically not Theos himself. He is the Son of Theos. He is the Son of God. But what I find interesting is the word living inserted there would be a Jewish, some sort of a Jewish mocking of the Roman gods. Because the Roman gods are bowing down to what? What is their primary worship referent? Statues. Marble stones. And they make fun of them. Can your God talk? Let's see him. Can he walk? He seems to be confined a little. If your God's so powerful, why can't he move? Your God's not living. Your God's dead. He's as alive as a stone. But guess what? Jesus is the King, not of just some random, you know, rock gods. He's the King of the living God. This is something that comes up a lot in intertestamental literature when they're making fun of the Greeks and the Romans because their gods claim to be living, but they're just mere stones. And I don't know about you, but stones aren't very living. Okay. So he says, basically, you are the King. Oh, yeah, you're the King. Oh, yeah, by the way, you're the King. And this distinctly contrasts what the crowds have said about Jesus. Because they've not claimed that he was the King. They've claimed that he is the one before the King comes. Peter gets it right. Nails it on the head. And Jesus says, he replies in verse 17, "Blessed are you." Blessed are you. What does that sound like? Beatitudes. Blessed are. Blessed are. Blessed are. What? What? The meek? What else? Those who mourn, what else? Peacemakers, what else? The weary, what else? The poor in spirit, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. And here, he takes that same formula, blessed are, and he replaces all those with you. Why? Because of the faith, because of the identification, because of the acknowledgement and the submission to Jesus' authority in both his word and deed that's articulated by Peter's proclamation, he fits the bill of people that belong to the kingdom. Blessed are you, Peter. Why? Well, I love this. I mentioned this yesterday. I'm going to mention it again. Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. The only time in all the Gospels that Peter is ever referred to as the son of Jonah. And I don't think it's an accident right off of a conversation about Jesus' identity in which Jesus says, "The only sign I will give you is the sign of Jonah." Too coincidental for me. I eventually pushed something over, and maybe that's not a coincidence. Maybe that's intentional. "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you..." Okay, hold on a second. Really quick. The "my" is significant in that phrase. What is that communicating? A little two letters tells me a lot. What does it tell me? You guys awake this morning? I'm going to keep asking questions. That's the way I roll. My. What is my? Why is my significant? Worship. What else?
Infer that he is the Son.
Infers that he is the Son. And it is claiming quite a deep intimacy with God, is it not? It's not just the Father in heaven. It's not just, you know, the nation's Father in heaven. It is my Father in heaven. Jesus claiming a proximity to God that is unparalleled. It's kind of like saying Abba. Pretty big deal. That's very irreverent. And you're only allowed to be irreverent with someone if you know them well, right? I have a hard time calling my mentor up in Lincoln anything other than Dr. Lowry, even though repeatedly he's told me to call him Bob. But not everybody can just call him Bob. Why? Because you have to have, in order to talk with him in that irreverence, you need to have a relationship that is intimate. And until he gives you that permission, you don't have the right to do that. You can do it and be disrespectful, and that's your choice. But ultimately, the only ones that have the right to call people by their, what's the word? By their name, that their more mundane name, are the people that, like my kids, they call Mark Moore Dr. or Mr. Mark. There is a little bit of an intimacy there because of how close Mark and I are. But my kids are still in a position where they need to be respectful. And until Mark one day looks at them and says, "Don't call me Mr., just call me Mark," that's what they need to call him. So the very usage of the word my, it communicates some sort of intimacy level of it. Anyway, okay, verse 18. "And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." Tell me, scholars, what is the debate about this passage?
Catholics.
that's the only way we're going to categorize this. Catholics. What is the issue with the Catholics on this debate?
They build St. Peter's on the body of Peter,
literally. Yeah. Well, yeah. Are you talking about the Basilica in Rome? Yeah, that's true too, which is fascinating. This is the passage, though, that the Catholics will refer to and say, this is why we look at Peter as the first pope. Because the name Peter in Greek means what? It is the Aramaic referent of what word, of what name? It means rock. And it is the Aramaic Cephas, which comes from John chapter 1, verse 42. When the word Cephas in Aramaic means rock. And what's interesting here is what we have is this. It's a play on words. It's very, very specific and intentional. He says, "And I tell you that you are rock, and on this rock I will build my church." To be flat out honest with you, it's a pretty good case to point this towards the person of Peter as far as what Jesus is building his church on. We have a couple of options here. Because what the Catholics say is that it's Peter, and they use the play on words that Jesus does here intentionally. They take it seriously. Then we have the second option, which is more our movement and the other non-Catholic movements. And that is, the rock is not Peter, because, I mean, the church can't be built off of a person, a man. It's only built on Jesus. Therefore, the rock is referring to the confession of Peter, the confession about who Jesus is. There's actually a lot of truth in that too. Here's my response to the whole debate. I'm pretty confused as to how you can separate the person from the confession, to be honest with you. I mean, even if you're talking about the confession, you're still saying it is Peter's confession, right? So, why would Jesus in any way, shape, or form even say that Peter was the one the church may build on? Because of his confession. Because it got it right. And I will say this. At Pentecost, who's the one that got up and spoke? Peter. The church was built from that day on. On what? The message, the proclamation of Peter, of his confession at Pentecost. I think it's both. Is it the confession? Yes. Is it Peter? Yes. Deal with it. The Catholics are not as far off on this as we like to snicker and giggle about. They really aren't. Frankly, I think they take the context of the text more seriously than what we do. Peter is exalted in some sense in this text. He just is. And that's okay. I mean, it's kind of like the whole rewards in heaven debate. I'm like, seriously? If I get the same rewards as Peter does, I will be mad. He deserves way more than me, honestly. He was crucified upside down. What happened to me? You know, Walmart says I can't say Merry Christmas anymore. That's the persecution I get? Really? We're both going to get the same rewards in heaven? That's bogus. I will protest the pearly gates if Peter's not getting more rewards than I am. You know what I mean? You hear my heart in that. Is that Peter does deserve recognition. Kind of like what we do with Mary. Man, we treat her just like this insignificant figure. Do I think she needs to be exalted to Immaculate Conception? No, that's a little bit going overboard. Let's calm down there. However, to treat her just like Deborah or any other woman in the Bible is ludicrous. Is ludicrous. We should honor her in a different way than what we do other women. Do you hear my heart in that? Okay, well, if not, that's okay. The whole debate, though, about whether or not the church is built off of Peter the person or the confession, my response is it's probably more both and than either or. It is Peter because he made the confession. Therefore, I think it's more than appropriate that our baptismal and membership rituals that we do say the Great Confession, because that is what the church is built on. Who Jesus is, as articulated by Peter. Job well done, friend. Even though in a moment, he's about to be harshly rebuked, even referenced as Satan. So let's keep that held in some sort of tension. However, the word that fascinates me about this passage even more than the word rock is what happens in the next phrase. This is where I think the debate kind of sidetracks us from the point of Jesus. Because Jesus says, "And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." And this is the word, the next couple of words is the ones that fascinates me. "And the gates of Hades will not overcome it." I've referenced this before, I think, either that or maybe it was my Christian life class. But the word gates to me is the most important word in this passage. Why? Because gates is a defensive weapon. It is the last line of defense whenever you are in a city and an enemy army is about to invade your territory. You cower behind the fence, hoping that that defensive weapon can protect you from the onslaught of the army. And who do the gates belong to in this passage? The kingdom of Satan. He is the one that is cowering when the kingdom of God moves in power. And yet we function in the world today like we are the ones hiding behind the gates. And that is just as bogus. Jesus is describing not just an exaltation of Peter. He's describing the power of the kingdom. The power of the kingdom to come and destroy the kingdom that is holding everyone in darkness and in bondage. He is setting the captives free. This is the message of this passage, not the word rock. The word rock is merely a vehicle to talk about the power of the kingdom. For on a rock, a house built on a rock, it will stand even in the most furious of storms. Have we heard that already in Matthew? The word rock is connoting power. So don't get me wrong. Is the debate something we need to look into? Absolutely. But don't get so involved in the debate that you miss the point of what Jesus is saying. That the kingdom of God is so powerful that the kingdom of Satan can only cower behind its last line of defense, its gates. And guess what? They won't hold up. The gates will be destroyed because the kingdom of God moving in power cannot be denied. Oh, that'll preach. Thank you. I was hoping that was going to come out sometime today. He then looks at Peter. He's still talking to Peter. And he says, "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be loosed in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Okay. Keys to the kingdom. Peter does exemplify throughout the rest of his ministry that he has the keys to unlocking the kingdom. At three specific junctures in the Gospel of Acts, Peter does unlock the kingdom. Where is the first one? What? Pentecost. Acts chapter 2. Exactly. Because he unlocks the kingdom to a primarily Jewish audience. What is Acts chapter 1 verse 8, the formula that we get for the laying out of the whole book of Acts that is significant? Yes, you will go into Jerusalem, Judea and Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. And Peter unlocks all three. Because he unlocks first Jerusalem in Acts chapter 2. Then you move to Acts chapter 8 with Simon the sorcerer, and he unlocks the Samaritans. He's the one that offers the message to the Samaritans. And then you have Cornelius in Acts chapter 10, where he unlocks the message of the kingdom to the ends of the earth. Matter of fact, after Acts chapter 10, whenever he does this whole Cornelius thing, what does he have to do in the very next chapter? Yeah, he has to go give an account as to why it was legitimate for him to actually do this. And guess who gets to do it? The one who holds the keys to the kingdom. And this is what this goes back to. Peter is the one that unlocks the message of the kingdom so that the people, both in Jerusalem, Judea, and in Samaria, and the ends of the earth, are able to actually hear it. Whatever you will loose on earth, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. If anything, what can be said about that is that this is authority language. And actually, if you think about what he's saying there, what he's saying is on earth, anything that you bind on earth will also be bound in heaven. Anything that you loose on earth will also be loosed in heaven. That is major authority. And it kind of reminds me of the language that Nero used to describe his own ministry as king, as emperor of Rome, in Dio Cassius. Remember we talked about that? Where he says that the fate of the nations is in his hands. And that if he decides that they're to live, they will live. But if he decides they'll die, they'll die. And he says everything, their prosperity, whether or not wars occur, everything is up to me. It's up to my decisions, Nero says. It's kind of like what he's saying. Whatever I loose on earth will be loose. Whatever I bind on earth will be bound also in heaven. Authority language, which describes the sovereignty of the kingdom. And Jesus' kingdom here is being established and defined as the disciples. Not Israel, not Rome, but the disciples. Justin. Yeah, and matter of fact, in the context we're going to be moving into chapter 18 with church discipline, it makes some sense. I take church discipline very seriously. I really do think that if we turn someone over to Satan, they have to repent before they're allowed back in the community. Because this isn't... See, and people are like, what does that mean about their salvation? This isn't a salvation question. This is a community question. It's a big difference. Are you a part of the community that is saved? See, matter of fact, we were just talking about this last night with some guys I was chatting with. One of the major flaws in the way in which we center a lot of the gospel on individualism is that we're constantly talking about what people are being delivered from, and we're not talking about what people are being delivered to. There's a major difference in those prepositions. We focus all of our evangelism on what you're being delivered from the guilt of sin, from damnation, from. And people get delivered from it and they're like, sweet, I'm done. Now what? Because all that I've been told is that everything that you guys are about is what I'm getting away from. And what I'm suggesting is that maybe we need to start changing what we're telling people evangelistically from what we're getting away from and tell them what they're going to be delivered to. You're delivered into salvation, but that's because you now belong to a community that is saved. You see the difference in that? What you win people with, you'll win people to. Guess what? If you win people with a message that's only about them, you'll win them to a very individualistic, self-centered Christianity. But if you win people to a community, their mentality changes. You see the difference in that nuance? That's something that will affect the way you do ministry forever, depending on which direction that you go. Will you have a whole bunch of self-centered pew fillers? Or will you have a community that's storming the gates of Hades? Big difference. So, when it comes to church discipline and even things like this revolving around sins, I do believe that salvation only comes through the body. I don't buy into this individual, well, hey, I just got Jesus, that's all I need. Well, guess what? It's not the way it works. You're also married to the ugly bride that he's got too. It's the way it is. Because I don't see multiple weddings at the eschaton. I see one between his bride and the bridegroom. Not the bridegroom and this person and this person and this person and this person. It's a people. And guess what? This people's been given all the authority. which is a pretty dangerous thing to say. And but guess what? The people that are also held in those authority, oh, they'll get theirs if they abuse it. It's not like they'll get away. And this to me kind of also does buck up a little bit against the whole concept of a pope. One person with that much control is not that wise. Because in one moment they can be saying the awesome things about Jesus being Christ, and the next moment we have to call him Satan and rebuke him. I think it's very wise to have a plurality of leadership. Because I'm a messed up person. I will also say this. I think it's important to have a plurality of leadership. Anytime you go into a church, you need to interview them. And one of the key questions you need to ask is how many people in leadership or in positions of influence have the same last name or come from the same family tree? You need to ask that question. Because if one family is predominantly, overwhelmingly in positions of influence in a church, it is unhealthy. Because there's not a plurality of leadership there. Because I promise you, when it comes to tough decisions, they're gonna be fighting for blood more than they are water. It's just the way it is. I've lived it. You guys hearing my heart in this? Is this a dangerous thing for Jesus to do? Oh yeah. But guess what? This is the plan, baby. This is the way the kingdom moves. Through a group of messed up people that have to be totally reliant on Jesus. Because if we choose to try to do it ourselves, we'll just be filled with a life full of worry. And we will make a mess of everything. But in this time, whenever the weeds and the wheats are growing up together, guess what? We will be victorious even in the face of evil. See how this all kind of ties together? Yeah. All right, let's keep moving. We got 11 minutes. We can finish this. Then he warned his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Christ. Awesome. I love that. From that time on, Jesus began to... Oh, wait a minute. What was significant about that? I'm sorry. What? The second major shift. Exactly. Where is the first one? Matthew chapter 4, verse 17. From that time on, Jesus began to preach, repent for the kingdom of heaven is near. And what does that first major shift, the first major shift, what does that point us to as far as Jesus' ministry? Where is his primary focus? Galilee. Now, in 16, chapter 21, everything will be moving towards Jerusalem. We've seen this boat starting to turn for a little while now, since the beginning of chapter 15. But now with the second major shift, everything is focused towards Jerusalem. Does that mean that he will no longer be in Galilee? No. It means that even his positioning of Galilee, it's ultimately driving both theologically, both narratively, and both literally, geographically, towards Jerusalem. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. This is the climactic point that we've been building to so far in the Gospel of Matthew. Because nowhere in the Gospel of Matthew has the program of Jesus, has the plan of Jesus, has the mission of the kingdom been more clearly articulated than that verse so far. For his whole purpose at this point now is to go to Jerusalem and at the hands of the Jewish elite to be killed and then to raise again. Why? Because this is how the kingdom wins. This is how we storm the gates of hell. This is how the kingdom is established. How? Through suffering, through sacrifice, through the resurrection. Verse 22, Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. have you ever been on a battlefield and you look over and one of the soldiers is going, "Excuse me, colonel or general or whatever, you're an idiot and let me tell you why." Like, is that okay in any army? No. I think it's ironic that whenever he rebukes Jesus, he even says, "Never, Lord." And my question is, do you really believe that word? When you say the word Lord, like, really? You have the right to rebuke your general. You have the right to rebuke emperor. If somebody went up and rebuked Nero, how do you think that would go down? "Nero, you're an idiot, and here's why." Really? Okay, well, after you get done talking, your head will be on a platter. You, It's ironic to me that he calls him Lord, and at the same time he functions as if he is the Lord of Jesus. "Never, Lord," he said. "This shall never happen to you." Why is he so up in arms? Why is he so upset? What? Yeah. Well, because from his Jewish lens, the Messiah doesn't die, the Messiah kills. Right? This will not happen to you. We don't establish a kingdom with you dying. We establish it through force. We establish it by putting our feet on the throat of the enemies. You are the king that's going to exalt Israel, that's going to destroy the enemies, that's going to make us kings. And Jesus looks at him and he says, "Get behind me, Satan." Why would Satan's name surface here? Because Peter is tempting Jesus in the exact same way that Satan tempted Jesus in chapter 4. The exact same way. Satan's temptations in the wilderness was to convince Jesus to be a different king of a different kingdom. He was telling him that your kingdom should be about you. That your kingdom should be one that serves you. That your kingdom can be attained without the cross. All you got to do, Jesus, is bow down and worship me, and I'll give you all the kingdoms of the earth and all their splendor, luxury, and power. Satan serves us here because Jesus realizes there's someone else lurking on the scene. Because what the eyes can see sometimes is betraying. Because the reality is there's a world that's functioning beyond what our eyes can see. And Satan is lurking even here. And we'll see the same thing at the foot of the cross. "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." Did you hear that? He's saying, can't you see the difference in the kingdoms? The things of men would be that the Messiah would come and kill and not be killed. But the things of God are different. We don't function that way. That's not how we win. Yes?
Do you think that was Satan speaking to Peter? Or was it still Peter's choice?
Oh, no, absolutely Peter's choice. I think it was something that Satan was whispering in his ear. But it's something that's... If you think about it... Another way of rephrasing this is Peter possessed by Satan in this moment or no? He's saying you belong to the same camp. You're fighting on the same side of the battlefield that Satan's fighting on. You have my side of the kingdom that's fighting, Satan's side of the kingdom. There's no in between. This is the battlefield. And you, because of what you've just said, have shown me that you're fighting from this side and not this side. So no, I think that at most we have evidence of Satan maybe whispering things in Peter's ear, but I have no evidence of Peter being possessed and Satan speaking through him. No. Then again, there's a lot of things that even I could say as a leader that would make a lot more sense in the battlefield of Satan than it would in the battlefield of God. But am I possessed by Satan? I like to think I'm not. I mean, I hope not. I claim to be, you know, possessed by the Holy Spirit. Although I have a lot of people that debate that with me. Sometimes my face, sometimes just through anonymous emails, which is awesome. Then verse 24. "Then Jesus said to his disciples, 'If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me.'" What did he just tell Peter? "Peter, don't you understand my political program? Don't you get it?" See, the cross... And the suffering here, let me, if you haven't made this application point, let's make it. The cross and the way of Jesus establishing the kingdom is not just something that happens at the establishment of the kingdom. It's what perpetuates the kingdom all throughout history. Which means, how Jesus fought in the battle is the same way you fight in the battle. Jesus doesn't look at us, and I'm just going to say this as blunt as I can. He doesn't look at you and say, "Pick up a sword and come follow me." No, my Jesus doesn't carry a sword, he carries a cross. And you know what? People can get upset with me until they're blue in the face. Bottom line is, I'm saying, listen, I don't know what else to say. That's what he's saying. He's saying, if you're going to follow me, join my failed revolution. How do you fight in this battle? You die. You suffer. You experience persecution on behalf of my name because my message will get you killed. Peter, this is how we win. And if you say anything else, which side of the battle are you fighting on? I mean, it's the way that context kind of builds it for me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses life for me will find it. I have an upside down kingdom. What good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world, yet forfeits his soul? If that's not attacking the political program of the Jewish lens, I don't know what is. Because what's the goal of the Jewish lens? To gain the whole world through the violent overthrow of the enemies. He says, what's good if that if you lose your soul? Who cares if you own the world? What's the world destined to ultimately anyway? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in His Father's glory with His angels, and then we reward each person according to what he has done. I tell you the truth, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom. Is that second coming talk? Huh? Is Jesus making a prognostication that some of the people, the disciples, will not die before they see the second coming? No. Sounds like it. But no. Because how do you define the word coming? Well, when it's right next to the word Son of Man, my first option should be Daniel chapter 7. My first option. And right here, the fact that he also couples it with some will not taste even death, but some of them will taste death before the Son of Man comes with the establishment of the kingdom. Who? Judas. Because when does Judas kill himself? When? Yeah, before he even dies on the cross. More or less the resurrection. Some of you will not even taste death before you see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom. What? So you are going to establish it. Yeah. But I'm not establishing it the way. How am I going to establish it? Well, just go up to verse 21. That tells you I'm going to establish it. I'm going to establish it through death, through sacrifice, through a cross. And guess what? That's the same way that you fight as a kingdom worker, as a soldier in this kingdom. And if you choose not to fight that way, you're choosing to go against the political program that Jesus established. It's 7:50 on the nose. How do you like that? All right. Love you guys. See you in the morning. If you have any-